this afternoon, I'm going to breeze through the lab. I want to just teach you a little bit about the labs that you can order and how you can read them. And then what we'll do is we'll move then into our section where we're going to go and teach you how to actually put your program together, which I think is the exciting part. Let's talk about lab. Now, not all of you are going to have within your scope of practice the ability to order lab. If you're a nutritionist, you don't necessarily get to do it, or a health coach or a nutrition coach don't necessarily have the licensure that a lab will acknowledge, but there are online direct lab services, and one of them is directlabs.com. It's basically a lab that was started online. There are MDs in the lab, and they sign off and they send the requisitions to the patients with their name on it, and they allow you to order whatever lab tests you want, and you don't have to wait for a doctor to order it for you. And they have a huge compendium of all kinds of blood tests. Plus, they have some of the functional medicine tests, like they offer some of the Great Smokies, which used to be called Great Smokies, now is Genova Diagnostics, like stool tests, adrenal tests, all sorts of things like that through Genova and Metametrics and a few others, at hair analysis. So whereas it used to be limited, where you had to be a practitioner who had that licensure to order the tests, anybody can, and all you have to do is tell people to go online, put in their credit card number, you tell them what to order, and they order it. So it's really quite cool, and I use it a lot. It's much easier for me to do that than it is for me to, you know, go through the whole lab requisition. Plus, it's a lot cheaper for the people. Like, for $97, they do their comprehensive wellness, which has all of your liver and your kidney and your thyroid and your bone metabolism stuff and your CBC, your complete blood count. And I think that's it for $97, whereas that would cost several hundred if you went through a normal MD's office. Okay, so what we're going to do, this is not a comprehensive course on lab assessment. I'm just going to talk to you about the ones that are specifically related to insulin resistance. And again, the information is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, not intended as medical advice. It's intended as a sharing of knowledge and experience from my research to you. And I encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based on your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare practitioner, in particular if you are on medications, especially blood glucose lowering and blood sugar lowering, and don't lower medication doses without consulting with the person who prescribed them. We're going to start with where we finished on the last talk, which was where the normal range of fasting blood sugar is. On most of the labs, they're going to show you that the normal fasting range is actually either 80 to 99 or some of them 65 to 99. That is not indeed the most healthy range. A healthy range is really in the low 80s, and it could also be in the mid to high 70s. Those are the healthiest ranges. Recent studies suggest that anytime you get into the mid 90 range, it predicts diabetes a year later. And a fasting glucose of above 90 is a predictor of cardiovascular damage. And there's a link to a study down at the bottom. It's from the journal Diabetes. So you can go there and look at that, and you can see the actual links to these studies. Incidentally, I studied with Paul Bergner. He's an herbalist, and I got a lot of my glucose references and a lot of the references to the literature from him, because he's an avid researcher, and he has a course. It's a audio. It's just an audio course that is called Insulin Resistance, the Pathophysiology and Therapeutics. And he talks a lot about the physiology, the pathology, all the different pieces that we're talking about. He gives you lots of references, and he talks about herbal therapeutics as well. So it's a very long and extended course, so if you want to get into more detail than we're going into, then you might want to order that course and study it. You will have to listen to it multiple times over to get it all, but lots of great information. So let's talk about one thing called hemoglobin A1C. A1C is just a nomenclature. It's also called hot glycosylated hemoglobin. And Bayari wants to know, how do you spell it? It's Paul Bergner. That's correct. B-E-R-G-N-E-R. And he's out of Colorado. Interesting character, very well researched, and just wisdom in regards to herbal medicine. So hemoglobin A1C is what's called glycosylated hemoglobin. And your red blood cells are floating around in your bloodstream, and there's also sugar floating around in your bloodstream. and the sugar kind of coats the red blood cells. You know, similar to if you were to spill honey or some kind of glucose solution, you see after when you comes back, it gets stiff. That's what the sugar does to your blood, red blood cells. Now, it's normal for a certain number of those red blood cells to have this glycosylation factor, to be kind of sticky and sharp. But the normal range of that is actually 4.5 to 5. That's what's considered the optimal range. And I actually need to update that chart, that slide, because I meant to say the normal range and what's acceptable is 4.1 to 5.7. And I'll talk about the optimal in a second. But let me just talk about what this does. When your blood cells get coated, they're much more able to damage your delicate blood vessel linings because they're kind of sharp, right? If you melt something and it gets coated, or you have sugar and it coats something and then it hardens up, it's sticky, it's hard, it has hard, sharp edges, and that's what happens with these red blood cells that are coated with hemoglobin. Not a big deal if you only have 4% of them that way, but when you get up into the 10, 11, 12% or higher, like diabetics have, most diabetics, uncontrolled, then you're in for a big surprise and a big problem. The glycosylation is totally reversible, very easily reversible, because your red blood cells die after 120 days. So when all the red blood cells have replaced themselves, if you've changed your diet and kept your glucose in a more optimal range, you're going to see a dramatic decrease in your hemoglobin A1C. What this does is represents, you can do an algorithm, and I'll show you how to calculate that in a second. You can do an algorithm that helps you to determine if your hemoglobin A1C is 5, what does that mean in terms of your average blood glucose? And at 5, it means that your average blood glucose was around 98. And when it's 4.5, it means that your average blood glucose was in the high 80s. And that's much more desirable. When you get up to even 5.3, you're up to about 106 as your high blood, or 105, something like that, as your average blood glucose. And when we say average, that means the while you're sleeping, if you maintain in the 80s while you sleep, and you're finding you have a hemoglobin A1C of even 5.3, that means that there are times when you're much, much higher than that, because 8 hours of the day, you're at 83. It's really something to take heart of how well controlled your glucose has been over time. And it can be decreased if you have hypoglycemia, like that flatline hypoglycemia, like you're always in the 50s, 60s. But it's rare. You rarely see that. And in some kind of hemolytic anemias or blood loss, and pregnancy. So anything that is causing you to have a decreased blood supply or an increased blood volume, like pregnancy. So it's percentage-wise, you'll be lower because there's more red blood cells when you're pregnant. So that's hemoglobin A1C. Here's a way that you calculate it. If a fasting glucose, I believe that based on my research, the ideal hemoglobin is, the hemoglobin A1C is somewhere between 4 and 5. It can go as low as 4. Once it gets below 4, you're heading more into the hypoglycemic range. And here's where I updated it to say hemoglobin A1C ideal is 4.5 to 5. If your fasting glucose is high, but you measure your hemoglobin A1C and it's within the normal or optimal range, it could be that you have a vitamin B1 deficiency. And vitamin B1 deficiency can actually be a predictor of diabetes. It's very commonly associated with diabetes. B1 deficiency can also cause you to have more of a leaky gut because B1 helps you to repair your gut. So that's kind of just a little clue. If you have a fasting glucose that's high and then you go check your hemoglobin A1C and it's perfectly normal, it may be because you have a vitamin B1 deficiency. So this site, if you click on that link or copy that and put it into your browser, you'll get a little calculator. So if you get your hemoglobin A1C tested and you know that it was, 4 and you want to know what your average blood glucose is, it will tell you. On the other hand, if you haven't tested your hemoglobin A1C but you know what your blood glucoses are, you can kind of get an idea of where it might be. Okay, so very useful link. And it's something you can send people to. Now, more and more, though, when you do lab tests, they're showing you what that hemoglobin A1C converts to in terms of the average glucose, right? Also, hemoglobin A1C is a test that you can do either in the lab or you can do it on your own. You can buy a kit. The kits are a little bit more complicated to do than the glucose. It's more than just stick your finger, stick it in a strip. It shows there's several stages and it takes about 5 minutes. The jury's out for me as to whether those home kits are as accurate. I had tested my hemoglobin A1C when I first started with the B4B Gone, and I had found that I was having high sugars. My A1C was about 5.4. Definitely, or 5.3, something like that. Definitely higher than optimal. And so I've been on this program. I've been keeping my blood sugars really, really steady. I went and tested it again, and it said it was 5.7. My husband, who's been keeping it really meticulously, even better than mine, in the 90s and very low hundreds, and rarely has a spike, he tested it and it was 6.3. So we are both going to go and get it tested at a lab to compare that. And what we'll probably do is the morning that we go to the lab, we'll have our blood tested, and either right before or right after, we'll test it with the kit. So when the results come back, we'll be able to compare. So the jury's out. The price is not that much less to do it that way. So if you are going to run some blood work, then it's certainly worth including hemoglobin A1C. I think it's about $35 for a test. And if you get two tests at Walgreens, you can get them for $35, and if you get one, it's $20. So it's a little bit less to do it on your own. The other advantage is if it is very accurate, then you can use it to check up. You don't have to go to the lab and have it done and pay the phlebotomy fees, but also the driving there and all that. Let's look at some other lab markers that are associated with insulin resistance. Fasting glucose, of course, the ideal being 75 to 89. Triglycerides, the ideal being 50 to 90. Triglycerides are fats that are combined with a glycerin, so it's triglycerides, and it's fatty acids. It's a storage form of fats. HDL of greater than 65, and even more telling is the ratio between triglycerides and HDL should be 1 triglycerides to HDL, so or better. So you're actually, your triglycerides should be lower or equal to your HDLs. And a lot of times we see people who have really low HDLs, like, oh gosh, in the 35s, and high, not such high triglycerides, but well, 80 or 90, that ratio is not good. And that foretells insulin resistance. Okay? On the other hand, some people have really high HDLs, and that's really good, but their triglycerides are over 100, so it balances it out. So you really want it to be so the triglycerides and HDL are roughly the same, with erring on the side of HDL being higher than triglyceride being higher. And fasting insulin, the ideal is actually 2 to 5. The average and the lab range allows it to go up to about 15. But if your fasting insulin is high, then you have that constant flood in your system. And that's usually indicative that you've got an issue going on. Even if your blood glucose is not high and your insulin is high fasting, that's a foreshadowing. And cholesterol is going to be lower than 200 when you have good glucose control. Hemoglobin A1C between 4.5 and 5. So what happens when we start to get into insulin resistance? Well, we start to see that fasting glucose inching up. According to the labs and the medical approach, anything over 99 fasting glucose is considered insulin resistance or prediabetes. But more of the research is showing that there's some dangers of being in the 90s at fasting glucose, where changes are starting to happen, and there's actually some consideration for lowering that to 90, that if you're above 90, you're going to be considered pre-diabetic. Your triglycerides, whoops, it says between, it should be less than 90. They might be 100, greater than 90, sorry, yeah, triglycerides greater than 90. Would indicate that there's some insulin resistance. You know, more so if it's over 100, but you know, as we're getting into being more ideal, over 90. Your HDLs are usually less than 65 when you have insulin resistance. They just start to drop. Your fasting insulin goes above 5, your cholesterol goes above 200, and your hemoglobin A1C maybe goes from 5.3 to 6.5. Now, if you have some of these and not all of them, it doesn't mean, oh, I don't have insulin resistance or I'm not at risk because I don't have all of these. No, these are the things that start to shift. So if you start to see one of these shift, then another of these shift, that means that you could be heading in that direction. So let's talk about metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is kind of a more advanced stage of insulin resistance, and it definitely is associated with the lipid changes. So if you've got the higher fasting blood sugar but not quite diabetic, and you've got some of these other issues going on, the hemoglobin A1C, the HDL triglyceride ratio is off, then it starts to become called metabolic syndrome when it's actually associated with the cardiovascular changes, like hypertension, like the high cholesterol. So you'll see the numbers are going much higher here. The fasting glucose, anything above 100, the triglycerides, anything greater than 110 is probably metabolic syndrome. HDL less than 55, so you can see that the ratio of triglycerides to HDL is 2:1. Your ideal, I didn't come out when I copied the slide. Cross the word ideal off on that slide. It should say insulin greater than 5, your cholesterol greater than 220, and hemoglobin A1C greater than 5.7. And it's usually associated with high blood pressure. The waist-hip ratio is greater than or equal to 0.8 in females or 1 in males, or if you have a waist of greater than 35 inches. And you have some combination of these, that would be considered metabolic syndrome, and it just means you're closer to diabetes and much more at risk for heart disease. And then the lab markers for diabetes. Fasting greater than 120 is what things are moving towards. Traditionally, it has been greater than 140 on 2 tests. That's your fasting. Your triglycerides, take out the word ideal again on all of these. I duplicated slides to save myself time, and then I forgot to take out, I remember taking those out. I think I just forgot to save it. Triglycerides greater than 110, HDL less than 55, similar to the metabolic syndrome. The insulin greater than 5, the cholesterol greater than 220, hemoglobin A1C definitely greater than 5.7. Usually in diabetics, when they're uncontrolled, it's greater than 7. Diabetics are traditionally considered under control when it's greater than 7. I'll be making changes to these slides and storing them back up, so if you haven't already printed them, wait until I send you an email that says that I've done that. Too many errors on those. And again, the same thing with the high blood pressure, waist-hip ratio. But the really hallmark difference between metabolic syndrome and diabetes is that the fasting glucose goes up and stays up, greater than 120 or even 140, or 2 subsequent tests is the traditional way. So this is a list of the different lab tests. I've given you the ranges here. This is a chart that is on your page. You can just click this and open this. You can use this as a reference when you're talking to people. You can send them to directlabs.com and you can ask them to get these tests. So what would we typically do? Well, the typical lab panel will include the glucose and the triglycerides and the HDL and the cholesterol. The fasting insulin is an extra test. Extra. I'll just put a dollar there because it costs extra to get the fasting insulin. Now, fasting insulin is a sign, if it's high, it's a sign of serious dysregulation. It's not done that often, but it can be useful. But a more useful thing would be doing your insulin after eating. The ideal would be, if you want to do a glucose tolerance test on your own, is to sit in the parking lot outside the lab, go in there and have your blood taken, come out to the car, eat a meal, go back in and have it taken again, and continue to do that over the course of the day just to see how it responds to the food. Realistically, it's not going to happen. I don't know anybody like that. Now, this may be something that the owners of the lab get to do on themselves or relatives and friends of those people. Not for the average person. It's just too cumbersome to do. Or if you go to a glucose tolerance test where you sit for 6 hours at a doctor's office and pay them a gazillion dollars to have them test you regularly. So let's go to the next page. We talked about hemoglobin A1C again. Another test that I will frequently do with people with insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, especially if we are starting to make changes and the changes aren't happening as quickly as we expect, it's possible that they're just not getting enough of their fatty acids or that their fatty acids are seriously out of balance, leading to inflammation. And there is a test by Metametrics that's available through directlabs.com. It's called the Blood Spot Fatty Acid Test. And it gives you the ratios between your EPA, DHA, your omega-3s, your omega-6, etc. So really valuable test. Vitamin D is super important. It's starting to be more commonly used as part of a routine exam, but not necessarily all the time. So you'll add vitamin D for sure to everybody because vitamin D will definitely improve insulin sensitivity. Then when we get into more sophisticated testing, when we have somebody who is actually diabetic and is or has a really high prediction for it based on family history and based on numbers, we can do some things to determine if they have an autoimmune process going on that's contributing to their blood sugar imbalance. And some of the tests that we do are C-peptide, and it's also known as insulin C-peptide or connecting peptide. And it measures how much residual beta cell function is still there based on your level of insulin secretion. So, and then also in islet cell antibodies, that's basically antibodies that are attacking your pancreas where it makes the insulin. And this is very commonly attributed to type 1 diabetes. But here's the thing, keep your eyes open for something called latent autoimmune adult onset diabetes. And it's people who have been falsely diagnosed as type 2 diabetics. They're doing the glucose medication. They're not getting their glucose levels under control. And the doctor says, oh, I guess we need to put you on insulin. That's not the typical course for a type 2 diabetic, especially if they are fairly good about their diet. The usual is that they will keep their diabetes under control with diet. But if you've got somebody who's told they're type 2 diabetic, they're not able to keep it under control directly with diet, at least with the diet that's conventionally given, they may have antibodies that are attacking their system, and they may not be type 2 at all. They just may be late onset autoimmune diabetes. And autoimmune diabetes is usually a type 1. Then you have this other set of antibodies, glutamic acid decarboxylase. It's an enzyme that's produced mainly by your pancreatic cells, and it makes GABA, and it actually gets attacked by antibodies and can contribute to the problem. There's also insulin antibodies, and you can test the insulin antibodies. I had a guy that came into me, I think it was last summer or last spring, and he was just beside himself. He was fit. He had lost a bunch of weight. He was looking trim. He was exercising. He was watching his diet to an extent, but not quite to the extent that we would tell him to watch his diet. But compared to most diabetics, he wasn't budging. His sugars were still in the 200s. He was on 3 oral diabetes medications, and the doctor said to him, if we can't get your sugars down, you know, in the next couple of months, you have to go on insulin. He didn't want to go on insulin. He did not want to. It was going to interrupt some of his pastimes and all. He was determined not to go on insulin. So I coached with him. I said, I don't think you have type 2 diabetes. You just don't have the classic build for it. I think you have this latent autoimmune. Are you willing to spend some money and get some antibodies tested? And it's not cheap. It cost him, you know, well over $600-$700 to get all this stuff tested. But the end result was we discovered that he was indeed an autoimmune diabetic. And no wonder none of the medications were touching it. Well, we put him on the diet, put him on the supplements, same stuff we're teaching here, did the same stuff with him. And within 3 days, he had his first glucose reading ever that was in the 70s. And within a couple of weeks, he was maintaining, mostly in the 90s, you know, still not maybe ideal, but he wasn't actually perfect either. And he wanted to get his hemoglobin A1C done. And I said, well, usually we wait 3 months to see a major change in that. Oh, I just want to see, because his had been 11 when we first tested him. I said, okay, but don't be disappointed if it's not all the way down where you want it to be, because I wouldn't expect it to be yet. You have to go through the full cycle. He said, no problem. I just want to see if there's been a change so I know. He got it tested. His hemoglobin A1C had dropped from 11 point something to 7 point something, which is huge. And that's considered controlled diabetic, which means that the doctor was going to stop bugging him about insulin. that he was doing fine that way. It can happen very quickly, very quickly. And then the last test I have on the list is a measure of adrenal stress. And within the Before Be Gone program, a couple of weeks ago, we had a bonus call on adrenals. And that is recorded in on the membership site. Blood sugar issues and adrenal problems are very intimately tied together. So if you do a panel that tests your adrenal hormones, also cortisol and DHEA, and you can tell what is going on with the system, what the cortisol levels are doing. Because remember, we talked that cortisol creates insulin resistance. So this is a great test for anybody that's dealing with adrenals, and we're going to have a whole topic module on adrenals later on in the year. This was just basically to say how important it really is to keep that blood sugar under 100, really ideally under 90. Beta cell destruction begins when your levels go above 100. Okay, and a small amount of beta cell dysfunction was detectable in people whose sugar only rose a little bit over 100 on a 2-hour glucose tolerance test. A little over 100 on a glucose tolerance test, which is a huge carbohydrate load. So every little increase in the 2-hour glucose tolerance test result corresponded to how much beta cell failure there was. So it's actually started as 100. So it's really important to keep it down there. Now, I'm not saying this to have you go freak out about this and oh my God, my sugars are going up, what am I gonna do? You're working on it, and you just maybe need to be a little bit more careful and watch things a little bit better, okay? Now, when you're working with people, you're definitely going to see some serious imbalances. And what do you do when you're in over your head? What do you do when you just don't know what to do? Well, you call on somebody that can help you. That's why if you're in a program with me where we're going to be doing a year-long program and we're going through this, you can bring your tough cases. We'll be having case study things. You just bring your tough cases and we talk about it. Not just do you benefit, not just does your patient benefit, but the whole group benefits by hearing other people's tough cases, right? The easy cases are easy. It's the tough cases that help us to learn a lot and to help us to really grow in our ability to help. So I want you to be able to handle the tough cases as well as the easy cases. This was another study that if somebody had at 1 hour a glucose of over 155, serious cardiovascular disease markers like high fibrinogen, high white blood cells, 1 hour plasma glucose in people with normal glucose tolerance associated with subclinical inflammation, high lipid ratios, and insulin resistance. Just at 1 hour, even if it was back to normal at 2 hours, which is when they usually only test, at 1 hour, if it's over 155, it's serious stuff. So it really is essential to keep that 1 hour reading below 140, I say below 110. Okay? People do live for years with blood sugars that high, but they aren't diagnosed. Cardiovascular disease largely goes undetected until for about 50% of the people who have it, their first sign is dropping dead of a heart attack. So this is silently happening inside of you. And this is the stuff you want to get across to your people. Okay, that's the end of our slide presentation. Bayari wants to know, what is hemolytic anemia? Hemolytic anemia is an anemia caused by breakdown of your blood cells. So it's basically, it's like internal bleeding. And Yvette says that 75% of diabetics have B1 deficiency. Tammy has a question about blood sugar that dips below the starting point. Tammy wants to know, what do you do for it? What do you do for situations when it goes down below? When the sugar goes down, that's reactive hypoglycemia, you basically do what we're doing. It's caused by excess insulin. It's caused by hyperinsulinemia, as Yvette wrote. Hyperinsulinemia is when you produce too much insulin. So what typically happens is you have a load of sugar, your insulin goes up, the cells are resistant, the insulin goes up more, the cells are resistant, and then by the time you get this huge influx of sugar, of insulin in there, and then it just starts whamming it away and putting it into fat, and your blood sugar goes way, way, way down. So the way that we're going to deal with it is the same way we're dealing with the whole situation, the whole insulin resistance. It's actually one of the stages on the continuum of insulin resistance. It's one of the earlier stages. So it's before you actually become as so resistant that your cells don't even take the insulin at all. So you basically, you're reducing the load of sugars, you're doing your supplements, and you're gradually spacing out the distance between your meals.